The Conquest of Bread by Peter Kropotkin. Preface. One of the current objections to communism and socialism altogether is that the idea is so old and yet it has never been realized. Schemes of ideal states haunted the thinkers of ancient Greece. Later on, the early Christians joined in communist groups. Centuries later, large communist brotherhoods came into existence during the Reform movement. Then the same ideals were revived during the great English and French revolutions, and finally, quite lately, in 1848, a revolution inspired to a great extent with socialist ideals took place in France. And yet we see, we are told, how far away is still the realization of your schemes. Don't you think that there is some fundamental error in your understanding of human nature and its needs? At first sight, this objection seems very serious. However, the moment we consider human history more attentively, it loses its strength. We see first that hundreds of millions of men have succeeded in maintaining amongst themselves, in their village communities, for many hundreds of years, one of the main elements of socialism, the common ownership of the chief instrument of production, the land and the apportionment of the same according to the labor capacities of the different families. And we learn that if the communal possession of the land has been destroyed in Western Europe, it was not from within, but from without, by the governments which created a land monopoly in favor of the nobility and the middle classes. We learn moreover that the medieval cities succeeded in maintaining in their midst, for several centuries in succession, a certain socialized organization of production and trade, that these centuries were periods of a rapid intellectual, industrial and artistic progress, while the decay of these communal institutions came mainly from the incapacity of men of combining the village with the city, the peasant with the citizen, so as jointly to oppose the growth of the military states, which destroyed the free cities. The history of mankind, thus understood, does not offer then an argument against communism. It appears, on the contrary, as a succession of endeavors to realize some sort of communist organization, endeavors which were crowned here and there with a partial success of a certain duration. And all we are authorized to conclude is that mankind has not yet found the proper form for combining, on communistic principles, agriculture with a suddenly developed industry and a rapidly growing international trade. The latter appears especially as a disturbing element, since it is no longer individuals only or cities that enrich themselves by distant commerce and export, but whole nations grow rich at the cost of those nations which lag behind in their industrial development. These conditions, which began to appear by the end of the 18th century, took, however, their full development in the 19th century, only after the Napoleonic Wars came to an end, and modern communism has to take them into account. It is now known that the French Revolution, apart from its political significance, was an attempt made by the French people in 1793 and 1794 in three different directions more or less akin to socialism. It was first the equalization of fortunes by means of an income tax and succession duties, both heavily progressive, as also by a direct confiscation of the land in order to subdivide it, and by heavy war taxes levied upon the rich only. The second attempt was a sort of municipal communism as regards the consumption of some objects of first necessity, bought by the municipalities and sold by them at cost price. And the third attempt was to introduce a wide national system of rationally established prices of all commodities, for which the real cost of production and moderate trade profit had to be taken into account. The convention worked hard at this scheme, and had nearly completed its work, when reaction took the upper hand. It was during this remarkable movement, which has never yet been properly studied, that modern socialism was born. Fourierism with Lange at Lyon, and authoritarian communism with Buonarroti, Babeuf and their comrades. And it was immediately after the Great Revolution that the three great theoretical founders of modern socialism, Fourier, Saint-Simon and Robert Owen, as well as Godwin, (the new state socialism), came forward, while the secret communist societies, originated from those of Buonarroti and Babeuf, gave their stamp to militant authoritarian communism for the next 50 years. To be correct then, we must say that modern socialism is not yet 100 years old, and that for the first half of these 100 years, two nations only, which stood at the head of the industrial movement, that is Britain and France, took part in its elaboration, both bleeding at that time from the terrible wounds inflicted upon them by 15 years of Napoleonic Wars, and both enveloped in the great European reaction that had come from the East. In fact, it was only after the Revolution of July 1830 in France and the reform movement of 1830-1832 in this country had begun to shake off that terrible reaction that the discussion of socialism became possible for a few years before the Revolution of 1848. And it was during those years that the aspirations of Fourier, Saint-Simon and Robert Owen, worked out by their followers, took a definite shape, and the different schools of socialism which exist nowadays were defined. In Britain, Robert Owen and his followers worked out the schemes of communist villages, agricultural and industrial at the same time. Immense cooperative associations were started for creating with their dividends more communist colonies, and the Great Consolidated Trades Union was founded, the forerunner of both the labor parties of our days and the International Working Men's Association. In France, the Fourierist Considérant issued his remarkable manifesto, which contains beautifully developed all the theoretical considerations upon the growth of capitalism, which are now described as scientific socialism. Proudhon worked out his idea of anarchism and mutualism without state interference. Blublanc published his Organization of Labor, which became later on the program of Lassalle. Vidal in France and Lorenz Stein in Germany further developed in two remarkable works published in 1846 and 1847 respectively, the theoretical conceptions of Considérant, and finally Vidal, and especially Péquer, developed in detail the system of collectivism which the former wanted the National Assembly of 1848 to vote in the shape of laws. However, there is one feature common to all socialist schemes of that period which must be noted. The three great founders of socialism who wrote at the dawn of the 19th century were so entranced by the wide horizon which it opened before them that they looked upon it as a new revelation, and upon themselves as upon the founders of a new religion. Socialism had to be a religion, and they had to regulate its march as the heads of a new church. Besides writing during the period of reaction which had followed the French Revolution, and seeing more its failures than its successors, they did not trust the masses, and they did not appeal to them for bringing about the changes which they thought necessary. They put their faith, on the contrary, into some great ruler, some socialist Napoleon. He would understand the new revelation. He would be convinced of its desirability by the successful experiments of their phalansteries or associations, and he would peacefully accomplish by his own authority the revolution which would bring well-being and happiness to mankind. A military genius, Napoleon had just been ruling Europe. Why should not a social genius come forward, carry Europe with him, and translate the new gospel into life? That faith was rooted very deep, and it stood for a long time in the way of socialism. Its traces are even seen among us, down to the present day. It was only during the years 1840-48, when the approach of a revolution was felt everywhere, and the proletarians were beginning to plant the banner of socialism on the barricades, that faith in the people began to enter once more the hearts of the social schemers. Faith on the one side in republican democracy, and on the other side in free association, in the organizing powers of the working men themselves. But then came the revolution of February 1848, the middle-class republic, and with it, shattered hopes. 4 months only after the proclamation of the republic, the June insurrection of the Paris proletarians broke out, and it was crushed in blood. The wholesale shooting of the working men, the mass deportations to New Guinea, and finally the Napoleonian coup d'état followed. The socialists were prosecuted with fury, and the weeding out was so terrible and so thorough that for the next 12 or 15 years, the very traces of socialism disappeared. Its literature vanished so completely that even names, once so familiar before 1848, were entirely forgotten. Ideas which were then current, the stock ideas of the socialists before 1848, were so wiped out as to be taken later on by our generation for new discoveries. However, when a new revival began, about 1866, when communism and collectivism once more came forward, it appeared that the conception as to the means of their realization had undergone a deep change. The old faith in political democracy was dying out, and the first principles upon which the Paris working men agreed with the British trade unionists and Owenites when they met in 1862 and 1864 at London was that the emancipation of the working men must be accomplished by the working men themselves. Upon another point, they also were agreed. It was that the labor unions themselves would have to get hold of the instruments of production and organize production themselves. The French idea of the Fourierist and Mutualist Association thus joined hands with Robert Owen's idea of a great consolidated trades union, which was extended down so as to become an international working men's association. Again, this new revival of socialism lasted but a few years. Soon came the war of 1870-71, the uprising of the Paris Commune, and again the free development of socialism was rendered impossible in France. But while Germany accepted now from the hands of its German teachers, Marx and Engels, the socialism of the French 48ers, that is, the socialism of Considérant and Louis Blanc, and the collectivism of Picquer, France made a further step forward. In March 1871, Paris had proclaimed that henceforward it would not wait for the retardatory portions of France, that it intended to start within its commune its own social development. The movement was too short-lived to give any positive result. It remained communalist only. It merely asserted the rights of the commune to its full autonomy. But the working classes of the old international saw at once its historical significance. They understood that the free commune would be henceforth the medium in which the ideas of modern socialism may come to realization. The free agro-industrial communes, of which so much was spoken in England and France before 1848, need not be small phalansteries or small communities of 2,000 persons. They must be vast agglomerations like Paris, or still better, small territories. These communes would federate to constitute nations in some cases, even irrespectively of their present national frontiers, open bracket, like the Cinque Ports or the Hansa, close bracket. At the same time, large labor associations would come into existence for the intercommunal service of the railways, the docks, and so on. Such were the ideas which began vaguely to circulate after 1871 among the thinking working men, especially in the Latin countries. In some such organization, the details of which life itself would settle, the labor circles saw the medium through which socialist forms of life could find a much easier realization than through the seizure of all industrial property by the state, and the state organization of agriculture and industry. These are the ideas to which I have endeavored to give a more or less definite expression in this book. Looking back now at the years that have passed since this book was written, I can say in full conscience that its leading ideas must have been correct. State socialism has certainly made considerable progress. State railways, state banking, and state trade in spirits have been introduced here and there. But every step made in this direction, even though it resulted in the cheapening of a given commodity, was found to be a new obstacle in the struggle of the working men for their emancipation. So that we find growing amongst the working men, especially in Western Europe, the idea that even the working of such a vast national property as a railway net could be much better handled by a federated union of railway employees than by a state organization. On the other side, we see that countless attempts have been made all over Europe and America, the leading idea of which is on the one side to get into the hands of the working men themselves wide branches of production, and on the other side to always widen in the cities the circles of the functions which the city performs in the interests of its inhabitants. Trade unionism, with a growing tendency towards organizing the different trades internationally and of being not only an instrument for the improvement of the conditions of labor, but also of becoming an organization which might at a given moment take into its hands the management of production, cooperation both for production and for distribution, both in industry and agriculture, and attempts at combining both sorts of cooperation in experimental colonies, and finally the immensely varied field of the so-called municipal socialism. These are the three directions in which the greatest amount of creative power has been developed lately. Of course, none of these may in any degree be taken as a substitute for communism, or even for socialism, both of which imply the common possession of the instruments of production. But we certainly must look at all these attempts as open experiments, like those which Owen, Fourier and Saint-Simon tried in their colonies, experiments which prepare human thought to conceive some of the practical forms in which a communist society might find its expression. The synthesis of all these partial experiments will have to be made someday by the constructive genius of some one of the civilized nations. But sample of the bricks out of which the great synthetic building will have to be built, and even samples of some of its rooms, are being prepared by the immense effort of the constructive genius of man. Brighton, January 1913. Chapter 1 of The Conquest of Bread, Our Riches. Part 1. The human race has traveled a long way since those remote ages when men fashioned their rude implements of flint and lived on the precarious spoils of hunting, leaving to their children for their only heritage a shelter beneath the rocks, some poor utensils, and nature. vast, unknown and terrific, with whom they had to fight for their wretched existence. During the long succession of agitated ages which have elapsed since, mankind has nevertheless amassed untold treasures. It has cleared the land, dried the marshes, hewn down forests, made roads, pierced mountains. It has been building, inventing, observing, reasoning. It has created a complex machinery, wrested her secrets from nature, and finally it pressed steam and electricity into its service. And the result is that now the child of the civilized man, fine at its birth, ready for its use, an immense capital accumulated by those who have gone before him. And this capital enables man to acquire, merely by his own labor, combined with the labor of others, riches surpassing the dreams of the fairy tales of a thousand and one nights. The soil is cleared to a great extent, fit for the reception of the best seeds, ready to give a rich return for the skill and labor spent upon it, a return more than sufficient for all the wants of humanity. The methods of rational cultivation are known. On the wild prairies of America, each 100 men, with the aid of powerful machinery, can produce in a few months enough wheat to maintain 10,000 people for a whole year. And where man wishes to double his produce, to treble it, to multiply it 100-fold, he makes the soil, gives to each plant the requisite care, and thus obtains enormous returns. While the hunter of old had to scour 15 or 60 square miles to find food for his family, the civilized man supports his household with far less pains and far more certainty on a thousandth part of that space. Climate is no longer an obstacle. When the sun fails, man replaces it by artificial heat, and we see the coming of a time when artificial light also will be used to stimulate vegetation. Meanwhile, by the use of glass and hot water pipes, man renders a given space 10 and 50 times more productive than it was in its natural state. The prodigies accomplished in industry are still more striking. With the cooperation of those intelligent beings, modern machines, themselves the fruit of three or four generations of inventors, mostly unknown, 100 men manufacture now the stuff to provide 10,000 persons with clothing for 2 years. In well-managed coal mines, the labor of 100 miners furnishes each year enough fuel to warm 10,000 families under an inclement sky. And we have lately witnessed the spectacle of wonderful cities springing up in a few months for international exhibitions, without interrupting in the slightest degree the regular work of the nations. And if in manufactures as in agriculture, and as indeed through our whole social system, the labor, the discoveries, and the inventions of our ancestors profit chiefly the few, it is nonetheless certain that mankind in general, aided by the creatures of steel and iron which it already possesses, could already procure an existence of wealth and ease for every one of its members. Truly we are rich, far richer than we think, rich in what we already possess, richer still in the possibilities of production of our actual mechanical outfit, richest of all in what we might win from our soil, from our manufacturers, from our science, from our technical knowledge, were they but applied to bringing about the well-being of all. Part 2. In our civilized societies we are rich. Why then are the many poor? Why this painful drudgery for the masses? Why even to the best paid workmen, this uncertainty for the morrow, in the midst of all the wealth inherited from the past, and in spite of the powerful means of production, which could ensure comfort to all, in return for a few hours of daily toil? The socialists have said it and repeated it unwearingly. Daily they reiterate it, demonstrating it by arguments taken from all the sciences. It is because all that is necessary for production, the land, the mines, the highways, machinery, food, shelter, education, knowledge, all have been seized by the few in the course of that long story of robbery, enforced migration and wars, of ignorance and oppression, which has been the life of the human race before it had learned to subdue the forces of nature. It is because, taking advantage of alleged rights acquired in the past, these few appropriate today 2/3 of the products of human labor, and then squander them in the most stupid and shameful way. It is because, having reduced the masses to a point at which they have not the means of subsistence for a month, or even for a week in advance, the few can allow the many to work, only on the condition of themselves receiving the lion's share. It is because these few prevent the remainder of men from producing the things they need, and force them to produce, not the necessaries of life for all, but whatever offers the greatest profits to the monopolists. And this is the substance of all socialism. Take indeed a civilized country. The forests which once covered it have been cleared, the marshes drained, the climate improved. It has been made habitable, The soil which bore formerly only a coarse vegetation is covered today with rich harvests. The rock walls in the valleys are laid out in terraces and covered with vines. The wild plants, which yielded naught but acrid berries or uneatable roots, have been transformed by generations of culture into succulent vegetables or trees covered with delicious fruits. Thousands of highways and railroads furrow the earth and pierce the mountains. The shriek of the engine is heard in the wild gorges of the Alps, the Caucasus, and the Himalayas. The rivers have been made navigable, the coast carefully surveyed or easy of access. Artificial harbours, laboriously dug out and protected against the fury of the sea, afford shelter to the ships. Deep shafts have been sunk in the rocks. Labyrinths of underground galleries have been dug out where coal may be raised or minerals extracted. At the crossings of the highways, great cities have sprung up, and within their borders, all the treasures of industry, science, and art have been accumulated. Whole generations that lived and died in misery, oppressed and ill-treated by their masters, and worn out by toil, have handed on this immense inheritance to our century. For thousands of years, millions of men have labored to clear the forests, to drain the marshes, and to open up highways by land and water. Every rood of soil we cultivate in Europe has been watered by the sweat of several races of men. Every acre has its story of enforced labor, of intolerable toil, of the people's sufferings. Every mile of railway, every yard of tunnel has received its share of human blood. The shafts of the mine still bear on the rocky walls the marks made by the pick of the workmen who toiled to excavate them. The space between each prop in the underground galleries might be marked as a miner's grave, and who can tell what each of these graves has cost, in tears, in privations, in unspeakable wretchedness, to the family who depended on the scanty wage of the worker cut off in his prime by fire damp, rockfall, or flood. The cities, bound together by railroads and waterways, are organisms which have lived through centuries. Dig beneath them, and you find, one above another, the foundations of streets, of houses, of theatres, of public buildings. Search into their history, and you will see how the civilization of a town, its industry, its special characteristics, have slowly grown and ripened through the cooperation of generations of its inhabitants, before it could become what it is today. And even today, the value of each dwelling, factory and warehouse, which has been created by the accumulated labor of the millions of workers, now dead and buried, is only maintained by the very presence and labor of legions of the men who now inhabit that special corner of the globe. Each of the atoms composing what we call the wealth of nations owes its value to the fact that it is a part of a great whole. What would a London dockyard or a great Paris warehouse be if they were not situated in these great centers of international commerce? What would become of our mines, our factories, our workshops, and our railways without the immense quantities of merchandise transported every day by sea and land? Millions of human beings have labored to create this civilization on which we pride ourselves today. Other millions, scattered through the globe, labor to maintain it. Without them, nothing would be left in 50 years but ruins. There is not even a fort or an invention which is not common property, born of the past and the present. Thousands of inventors, known and unknown, who have died in poverty, have cooperated in the invention of each of these machines, which embody the genius of man. Thousands of writers, of poets, of scholars, have labored to increase knowledge, to dissipate error, and to create that atmosphere of scientific thought, without which the marvels of our century could never have appeared. And these thousands of philosophers, of poets, of scholars, of inventors, have themselves been supported by the labor of past centuries. They have been upheld and nourished through life, both physically and mentally, by legions of workers and craftsmen of all sorts. They have drawn their motive force from the environment. The genius of a Seguin, a Meyer, a Grove, has certainly done more to launch industry in new directions than all the capitalists in the world. But men of genius are themselves the children of industry as well as of science. Not until thousands of steam engines had been working for years before all eyes, constantly transforming heat into dynamic force, and this force into sound, light and electricity, could the insight of genius proclaim the mechanical origin and the unity of the physical forces. And if we, children of the 19th century, have at last grasped this idea, if we now know how to apply it, it is again because daily experience has prepared the way. The thinkers of the 18th century saw and declared it. but the idea remained undeveloped because the 18th century had not grown up like ours, side by side with the steam engine. Imagine the decades that might have passed while we remained in ignorance of this law, which has revolutionized modern industry. Had Watt not found at Soho skilled workmen to embody his ideas in metal, bringing all the parts of his engine to perfection, so that steam, pent in a complete mechanism and rendered more docile than a horse, more manageable than water, became at last the very soul of modern industry. Every machine has had the same history, a long record of sleepless nights and of poverty, of disillusions and of joys, of partial improvements discovered by several generations of nameless workers who have added to the original invention these little nothings, without which the most fertile idea would remain fruitless. More than that, every new invention is a synthesis, the result of innumerable inventions which have preceded it in the vast field of mechanics and industry. Science and industry, knowledge and application, discovery and practical realization leading to new discoveries, cunning of brain and of hand, toil of mind and muscle, all work together. Each discovery, each advance, each increase in the sum of human riches owes its being to the physical and mental travail of the past and the present. By what right, then, can anyone whatever appropriate the least morsel of this immense whole and say, "This is mine, not yours"? Part 3. It has come about, however, in the course of the ages traversed by the human race, that all that enables man to produce and to increase his power of production has been seized by the few. Sometime, perhaps, we will relate how this came to pass. For the present, let it suffice to say the fact and analyze its consequences. Today the soil, which actually owes its value to the needs of an ever-increasing population, belongs to a minority who prevent the people from cultivating it, or do not allow them to cultivate it according to modern methods. The mines, though they represent the labor of several generations and derive their sole value from the requirements of the industry of a nation and the density of the population, the mines also belong to the few, and these few restrict the output of coal or prevent it entirely if they find more profitable investments for their capital. Machinery, too, has become the exclusive property of the few, and even when a machine incontestably represents the improvements added to the original rough invention by 3 or 4 generations of workers, it nonetheless belongs to a few owners. And if the descendants of the very inventor who constructed the first machine for lace making a century ago were to present themselves today in a lace factory at Bale or Nottingham and claim their rights, they would be told, "Hands off, this machine is not yours," and they would be shut down if they attempted to take possession of it. The railways, which would be useless as so much old iron without the teeming population of Europe, its industry, its commerce and its marts, belong to few shareholders, ignorant perhaps of the whereabouts of the lines of rails which yield them revenues greater than those of medieval kings. And if the children of those who perished by thousands while excavating the railway cuttings and tunnels were to assemble one day, crowding in their rags and hunger, to demand bread from the shareholders, they would be met with bayonets and grapeshot to disperse them and safeguard vested interests. In virtue of this monstrous system, the son of the worker, on entering life, finds no field which he may till, no machine which he may tend, no mine in which he may dig, without accepting to leave a great part of what he will produce to a master. He must sell his labor for a scant and uncertain wage. His father and his grandfather have toiled to drain this field, to build this mill, to perfect this machine. They gave to the work the full measure of their strength, and what more could they give? But there here comes into the world poorer than the lowest savage. If he obtains leave to till the fields, it is on condition of surrendering a quarter of the produce to his master, and another quarter to the government and the middlemen. And this tax, levied upon him by the state, the capitalist, the lord of the manor, and the middleman, is always increasing. It rarely leaves him the power to improve his system of culture. If he turns to industry, he is allowed to work, though not always even that, only on condition that he yield a half or two-thirds of the product to him whom the land recognizes as the owner of the machine. We cry shame on the feudal baron who forbade the peasant to turn a clod of earth unless he surrendered to his lord a fourth of his crop. We call those the barbarous times. But if the forms have changed, the relations have remained the same, and the worker is forced, under the name of free contract, to accept feudal obligations. For turn where he will, he can find no better conditions. Everything has become private property, and he must accept or die of hunger. The result of this state of things is that all our production tends in a wrong direction, Enterprise takes no thought for the needs of the community. Its only aim is to increase the gains of the speculator. Hence the constant fluctuations of trade, the periodical industrial crises, each of which throws scores of thousands of workers on the streets. The working people cannot purchase with their wages the wealth which they have produced, and industry seeks foreign markets among the moneyed classes of other nations. In the East, in Africa, everywhere, in Egypt, Tonkin, or the Congo, the European is thus bound to promote the growth of serfdom, and so he does. But soon he finds that everywhere there are similar competitors. All the nations evolve on the same lines, and wars, perpetual wars, break out for the right of precedence in the market. Wars for the possession of the East, wars for the empire of the sea, wars to impose duties on imports and to dictate conditions to neighboring states, wars against those blacks who revolt. The roar of the cannon never ceases in the world. Whole races are massacred. The states of Europe spend a third of their budgets in armaments, and we know how heavily these taxes fall on the workers. Education still remains the privilege of a small minority, for it is idle to talk of education when the workman's child is forced, at the age of 13, to go down into the mine or to help his father on the farm. It is idle to talk of studying to the worker who comes home in the evening, worried by excessive toil and its brutalizing atmosphere. Society is thus bound to remain divided into two hostile camps, and in such conditions, freedom is a vain word. The radical begins by demanding a greater extension of political rights, but he soon sees that the breath of liberty leads to the uplifting of the proletariat, and then he turns round, changes his opinions, and reverts to repressive legislation and government by the sword. A vast array of courts, judges, executioners, policemen, and gaolers is needed to uphold these privileges, and this array gives rise in its turn to a whole system of espionage, of false witness, of spies, of threats, and corruption. The system under which we live checks in its turn the growth of the social sentiment. We all know that without uprightness, without self-respect, without sympathy and mutual aid, humankind must perish, as perish the few races of animals living by rapine, or the slave-keeping ants. But such ideas are not to the taste of the ruling classes, and they have elaborated a whole system of pseudoscience to teach the contrary. Fine sermons have been preached on the text that those who have should share with those who have not, but he who would carry out this principle would be speedily informed that these beautiful sentiments are all very well in poetry, but not in practice. To lie is to degrade and besmirch oneself, we say, and yet all civilized life becomes one huge lie. We accustom ourselves and our children to hypocrisy, to the practice of a double-faced morality, and since the brain is ill at ease among lies, we cheat ourselves with sophistry. Hypocrisy and sophistry become the second nature of a civilized man. But a society cannot live thus. It must return to truth, or cease to exist. Thus the consequences which spring from the original act of monopoly spread through the whole of social life. Under pain of death, human societies are forced to return to first principles, the means of production being the collective work of humanity. The product should be the collective property of a race. Individual appropriation is neither just nor serviceable. All belongs to all. All things are for all men, since all men have need of them, since all men have worked in the measure of their strength to produce them, and since it is not possible to evaluate everyone's part in the production of the world's wealth. All things for all. Here is an immense stock of tools and implements. Here are all those iron slaves, which we call machines, which saw and plane, spin and weave for us, and making and remaking, working up raw matter to produce the marvels of our time. But nobody has the right to seize a single one of these machines and say, "This is mine. If you want to use it, you must pay me a tax on each of your products," any more than the feudal lord of medieval times had the right to say to the peasant, "This hill, this meadow belong to me, and you must pay me a tax on every sheaf of corn you reap, on every brick you build." All is for all. If the men and the women bear their fair share of work, they have a right to their fair share of all that is produced by all, and that share is enough to secure them well-being. No more of such vague formulas as the right to work, or to each the whole result of his labor. What we proclaim is the right to well-being, well-being for all. Chapter Well-being for All, Part 1. Well-being for all is not a dream. It is possible, realizable, owing to all that our ancestors have done to increase our powers of production. We know indeed that the producers, although they constitute hardly one-third of the inhabitants of civilized countries, even now produce such quantities of goods that a certain degree of comfort could be brought to every hearth. We know further that if all those who squander today the fruits of others' toil were forced to employ their leisure in useful work, our wealth would increase in proportion to the number of producers, and more. Finally, we know that contrary to the theory enunciated by Malthus, that oracle of middle-class economics, the productive powers of the human race increase at a much more rapid ratio than its powers of reproduction. The more thickly men are crowded on the soil, the more rapid is the growth of their wealth-creating power. Thus, although the population of England has only increased from 1844 to 1890 by 62%, its production has grown, even at the lowest estimate, at double that rate, to wit, by 130%. In France, where the population has grown more slowly, the increase in production is nevertheless very rapid. Notwithstanding the crisis through which agriculture is frequently passing, notwithstanding state interference, the blood tax (conscription) and speculative commerce and finance, the production of wheat in France has increased fourfold, and industrial production more than tenfold, in the course of the last 80 years. In the United States, this progress is still more striking. In spite of immigration, or rather precisely because of the influx of surplus European labor, the United States have multiplied their wealth tenfold. However, these figures give but a very faint idea of what our wealth might become under better conditions. For alongside of the rapid development of our wealth-producing powers, we have an overwhelming increase in the ranks of the idlers and middlemen. Instead of capital gradually concentrating itself in a few hands, so that it would only be necessary for the community to dispossess a few millionaires and enter upon its lawful heritage, instead of this socialist focus proving true, the exact reverse is coming to pass. The swarm of parasites is ever increasing. In France, there are not 10 actual producers to every 30 inhabitants. The whole agricultural wealth of the country is the work of less than 7 millions of men. And in the two great industries, mining and the textile trades, you will find that the workers number less than 2.5 million. But the exploiters of labor, how many are they? In the United Kingdom, a little over 1 million workers, men, women and children, are employed in all the textile trades. Less than 900,000 work the mines, much less than 2 million till the ground, and it appeared from the last industrial census that only a little over 4 million men, women and children were employed in all the industries, (footnote) 4,013,711 now employed in all the 53 branches of different industries, including the state ordnance works, and 241,530 workers engaged in the construction and maintenance of railways, their aggregate production reaching the value of £1,041,037,000, and the net output being £406,799,000. (Footnote) So that the statisticians have to exaggerate all the figures in order to establish a maximum of 8 million producers to 45 million inhabitants. Strictly speaking, the creators of the goods exported from Britain to all the ends of the earth comprise only from 6 to 7 million workers. And what is the number of the shareholders and middlemen who levy the first fruits of labor from far and near, and heap up unearned gains by thrusting themselves between the producer and the consumer? Nor is this all. The owners of capital constantly reduce the output by restraining production. We need not speak of the cartloads of oysters thrown into the sea to prevent a dainty, hitherto reserved for the rich, from becoming a food for the people. We need not speak of the 1,001 luxuries, stuff, foods, etc., etc., treated after the same fashion as the oysters. It is enough to remember the way in which the production of the most necessary things is limited. Legends of miners are ready and willing to dig out coal every day and send it to those who are shivering with cold. But too often a third, or even one half, of their number are forbidden to work more than 3 days a week, because forsooth, the price of coal must be kept up. Thousands of weavers are forbidden to work the looms, although their wives and children go in rags, and although three-quarters of the population of Europe have no clothing worthy the name. Hundreds of blast furnaces, thousands of factories periodically stand idle. Others only work half-time, and in every civilized nation, there is a permanent population of about 2 million individuals who ask only for work, but to whom work is denied. How gladly would these millions of men set to work to reclaim wastelands, or to transform ill-cultivated land into fertile fields, rich in harvest? A year of well-directed toil would suffice to multiply fivefold the produce of those millions of acres in this country, which lie idle now as permanent pasture, or of those dry lands in the south of France, which now yield only about 8 bushels of wheat per acre. But men who would be happy to become hardy pioneers in so many branches of wealth-producing activity must remain idle because the owners of the soil, the mines and the factories prefer to invest their capital, taken in the first place from the community, in Turkish or Egyptian bonds or in Patagonian gold mines, and so make Egyptian fellahs, Italian emigrants, and Chinese coolies their wage slaves. This is the direct and deliberate limitation of production. But there is also a limitation indirect and not of set purpose, which consists in spending human toil on objects absolutely useless or destined only to satisfy the dull vanity of the rich. It is impossible to reckon in figures the extent to which wealth is restricted indirectly, the extent to which energy is squandered, while it might have served to produce and above all to prepare the machinery necessary to production. It is enough to cite the immense sums spent by Europe in armaments for the sole purpose of acquiring control of markets, and so forcing her own goods on neighboring territories and making exploitation easier at home, the millions paid every year to officials of all sorts, whose function it is to maintain the rights of minorities, the right that is of a few rich men to manipulate the economic activities of a nation, the millions spent on judges, prisons, policemen, and all the paraphernalia of so-called justice, spent to no purpose, because we know that every alleviation, however slight, of the wretchedness of our great cities is always followed by a considerable diminution of crime. Lastly, the millions spent on propagating pernicious doctrines by means of the press, and news cooked in the interest of this or that party, of this politician or of that group of speculators. But over and above this, we must take into account all the labor that goes to sheer waste, here in keeping up the stables, the kennels, and the retinue of the rich, there in pandering to the caprices of society and the depraved taste of a fashionable mob, there again in forcing the consumer to buy what he does not need, or posting an inferior article upon him by means of puffery, and in producing, on the other hand, wares which are absolutely injurious but profitable to the manufacturer. What is squandered in this manner would be enough to double the production of useful things, also to plenish our mills and factories with machinery that they would soon flood the shops with all that is now lacking to two-thirds of a nation. Under our present system, a full quarter of the producers in every nation are forced to be idle for 3 or 4 months in the year, and the labor of another quarter, if not of a half, has no better results than the amusement of the rich or the exploitation of the public. Thus, if we consider on the one hand the rapidity with which civilized nations augment their powers of production, and on the other hand the limits set to their production, be it directly or indirectly, by existing conditions we cannot but conclude that an economic system a trifle more reasonable would permit them to heap up in a few years so many useful products that they would be constrained to say, "Enough, we have enough coal and bread and raiment, let us rest and consider how best to use our powers, how best to employ our leisure." No, plenty for all is not a dream, though it was a dream indeed in those days when man, for all his pains, could hardly win a few bushels of wheat from an acre of land and had to fashion by hand all the implements he used in agriculture and industry. Now it is no longer a dream, because man has invented a motor which, with a little iron and a few sacks of coal, gives him the mastery of a creature strong and docile as a horse, and capable of setting the most complicated machinery in motion. But if plenty for all is to become a reality, this immense capital, cities, houses, pastures, arable lands, factories, highways, education, must cease to be regarded as private property, for the monopolist to dispose of at his pleasure. This rich endowment, painfully won, builded, fashioned, or invented by our ancestors, must become common property, so that the collective interests of men may gain from it the greatest good for all. There must be expropriation, the well-being of all, the end, expropriation, the means, part two. Expropriation, such then, is the problem which history has put before the men of the 20th century, the return to communism in all that ministers to the well-being of men. But this problem cannot be solved by means of legislation. No one imagines that. The poor as well as the rich understand that neither the existing governments, nor any which might arise out of possible political changes, would be capable of finding such a solution. They feel the necessity of a social revolution, and both rich and poor recognize that this revolution is imminent, that it may break out in a few years. A great change in thought has taken place during the last half of the 19th century, but suppressed as it was by the propertied classes and denied its natural development, this new spirit must now break its bond by violence and realize itself in a revolution. Whence will the revolution come? How will it announce its coming? No one can answer these questions. The future is hidden. But those who watch and think do not misinterpret the signs. Workers and exploiters, revolutionists and conservatives, thinkers and men of action, all feel that a revolution is at our doors. Well then, what are we going to do when the thunderbolt has fallen? We have all been bent on studying the dramatic side of revolution so much, and the practical work of revolution so little, that we are apt to see only the stage effects, so to speak, of these great movements, the fight of the first days, the barricades. But this fight, this first skirmish, is soon ended, and it only after a breakdown of the whole system that the real work of revolution can be said to begin. Effete and powerless, attack on all sides, the old rulers are soon swept away by the breath of insurrection. In a few days, the middle-class monarchy of 1848 was no more, and while Louis-Philippe was making good his escape in a cab, Paris had already forgotten her citizen king. The government of Thiers disappeared on the 18th of March 1871 in a few hours, leaving Paris mistress of her destinies. Yet 1848 and 1871 were only insurrections. Before a popular revolution, the masters of the old order disappear with a surprising rapidity. Its upholders fly the country to plot in safety elsewhere and to devise measures for their return. The former government having disappeared, the army, hesitating before the tide of popular opinion, no longer obeys its commanders, who have also prudently decamped. The troops stand by without interfering, or join the rebels. The police, standing at ease, are uncertain whether to belabor the crowd or to cry "Long live the Commune," while some retire to their quarters to await the pleasure of a new government. Wealthy citizens pack their trunks and betake themselves to places of safety. The people remain. This is how a revolution is ushered in. In several large towns, the Commune is proclaimed. In the streets wander scores of thousands of men, and in the evening they crowd into improvised clubs asking, "What shall we do?" and ardently discuss public affairs. All take an interest in them. Those who yesterday were quite indifferent are perhaps the most zealous. Everywhere there is plenty of goodwill and a keen desire to make victory certain. It is a time when acts of supreme devotion are occurring. The masses of the people are full of a desire of going forward. All this is splendid, sublime, but still it is not a revolution. Nay, it is only now that the work of a revolutionist begins. Doubtless there will be acts of vengeance. The Watrins and the Thomases will pay the penalty of their unpopularity. But these are mere incidents of the struggle, not the revolution. Socialist politicians, radicals, neglected geniuses of journalism, stop orators, both middle-class people and workmen, will hurry to the town hall, to the government offices, to take possession of the vacant seats. Some will decorate themselves with gold and silver lace to their heart's content, admire themselves in ministerial mirrors, and study to give orders with an air of importance appropriate to their new position. How could they impress their comrades of the office or the workshop without having a red sash, an embroidered cap, and magisterial gestures? Others will bury themselves in official papers, trying with the best of wills to make head or tail of them. They will indict laws and issue high-flown worded decrees that nobody will take the trouble to carry out, because revolution has come. To give themselves an authority which they have not, they will seek the sanction of all forms of government. They will take the names of provisional government, committee of public safety, mayor, governor of a town hall, commissioner of public safety, and what not. Elected or acclaimed, they will assemble in boards or in communal councils, where men of 10 or 20 different schools will come together, representing not as many private chapels, as it is often said, but as many different conceptions regarding the scope, the bearing, and the goal of a revolution. Possibilists, collectivists, radicals, Jacobins, Blanquists will be thrust together and waste time in wordy warfare. Honest men will be huddled together with the ambitious ones, whose only dream is power and who spurn the crown whence they are sprung. All coming together with diametrically opposed views, all forced to enter into ephemeral alliances in order to create majorities that can but last a day. Wrangling, calling each other reactionaries, authoritarians, and rascals, incapable of coming to an understanding on any serious measure, dragged into discussions about trifles, producing nothing better than bombastic proclamations, all giving themselves an awful importance, while the real strength of a movement is in the streets. All this may please those who like the stage, but it is not revolution. Nothing has been accomplished as yet, and meanwhile the people suffer. The factories are idle, the workshops close, trade is at a standstill. The worker does not even earn the meager wage which was his before. food goes up in price. With that heroic devotion which has always characterized them, and which in great crises reaches the sublime, the people will wait patiently. "We place these 3 months of want at the service of the Republic," they said in 1848, while their representatives and the gentlemen of the new government, down to the meanest jack in office, receive their salary regularly. The people suffer. With the childlike faith, with the good humor of the masses who believe in their leaders, they think that yonder, in the house, in the town hall, in the committee of public safety, their welfare is being considered. But yonder, they are discussing everything under the sun, except the welfare of the people. In 1793, while famine ravaged France and crippled the revolution, whilst the people were reduced to the depths of misery, although the Champs-Élysées were lined with luxurious carriages where women displayed their jewels and splendor, Robespierre was urging the Jacobins to discuss his treatise on the English Constitution. While the worker was suffering in 1848 from the general stoppage of trade, the Provisional Government and the National Assembly were wrangling over military pensions and prison labor without troubling how the people managed to live during the terrible crisis. And could one cast a reproach at the Paris Commune, which was born beneath the Prussian cannon and lasted only 70 days? It would be for this same error, this failure to understand that the revolution could not triumph unless those who fought on its side were fed, that on 15 pence a day a man cannot fight on the ramparts and at the same time support a family. The people will suffer and say, how is a way out of these difficulties to be found? Part 3. It seems to us that there is only one answer to this question. We must recognize and loudly proclaim that everyone, whatever his grade in the old society, whether strong or weak, capable or incapable, has before everything the right to live, and that society is bound to share amongst all, without exception, the means of existence it has at its disposal. We must acknowledge this, and proclaim it aloud, and act up to it. Affairs must be managed in such a way that from the first day of the revolution, the worker shall know that a new era is opening before him, that henceforward, none need crouch under the bridges, while palaces are hard by, none need force in the midst of plenty, none need perish with cold near shops full of furs, that all is for all, in practice as well as in theory, and that at last, for the first time in history, a revolution has been accomplished which considers the needs of the people before schooling them in their duties. This cannot be brought about by acts of parliament, but only by taking immediate and effective possession of all that is necessary to ensure the well-being of all. This is the only really scientific way of going to work, the only way which can be understood and desired by the mass of the people. We must take possession in the name of the people, of the granaries, the shops full of clothing, and the dwelling houses. Nothing must be wasted. We must organize without delay a way to feed the hungry, to satisfy all wants, to meet all needs, to produce not for the special benefit of this one or that one, but so as to ensure to society as a whole its life and further development. Enough of ambiguous words like the right to work, with which the people were misled in 1848, and which are still resorted to with the hope of misleading them. Let us have the courage to recognize that well-being for all, henceforward possible, must be realized. When the workers claimed the right to work in 1848, national and municipal workshops were organized, and workmen were sent to dredge there at the rate of 1s. 8d. 8d. When they asked the organization of labor, the reply was, "Patience, friends, the government will see to it. Meantime, here is your 1s. 8d. Rest now, brave toiler, after your lifelong struggle for food." And in the meantime, the cannons were overhauled, the reserves called out, and the workers themselves disorganized by the many methods well known to the middle classes, till one fine day, in June 1848, 4 months after the overthrow of the previous government, they were told to go and colonize Africa, or be shut down. Very different will be the result if the workers claim the right to well-being. In claiming that right, they claim the right to take possession of the wealth of the community, to take houses to dwell in according to the needs of each family, to socialize the stores of food and learn the meaning of plenty, after having known famine too well. They proclaim their right to all social wealth, fruit of the labor of past and present generations, and learn by its means to enjoy those higher pleasures of art and science which have too long been monopolized by the rich. And while asserting their right to live in comfort, they assert what is still more important, their right to decide for themselves what this comfort shall be, what must be produced to ensure it, and what discarded as no longer of value. The right to well-being means the possibility of living like human beings, and of bringing up children to be members of a society better than ours, whilst the right to work only means the right to be always a wage slave, a drudge, ruled over and exploited by the middle class of the future. The right to well-being is the social revolution. The right to work means nothing but the treadmill of commercialism. It is high time for the worker to assert his right to the common inheritance and to enter into possession of it. Chapter 3. Anarchist Communism. Part 1. Every society, on abolishing private property, will be forced, we maintain, to organize itself on the lines of communistic anarchy. Anarchy leads to communism, and communism to anarchy, both alike being expressions of the predominant tendency in modern societies, the pursuit of equality. Time was when a peasant family could consider the corn it sowed and reaped, or the woolen garments woven in the cottage, as the products of its own soil. But even then, this way of looking at things was not quite correct. There were the roads and the bridges made in common, the swamps drained by common toil, the communal pastures enclosed by hedges, which were kept in repair by each and all. If the looms for weaving or the dyes for colouring fabrics were improved by somebody, all profited. And even in those days, a peasant family could not live alone, but was dependent in a thousand ways on the village or the commune. But nowadays, in the present state of industry, when everything is interdependent, when each branch of production is knit up with all the rest, the attempt to claim an individualist origin for the products of industry is absolutely untenable. The astonishing perfection attained by the textile or mining industries in civilized countries is due to the simultaneous development of a thousand other industries, great and small, to the extension of the railroad system, to interoceanic navigation, to the manual skill of thousands of workers, to a certain standard of culture reached by the working class as a whole, to the labors, in short, of men in every corner of the globe. The Italians who died of cholera while making the Suez Canal, or of ankylosis in the St. Gothard Tunnel, and the Americans mowed down by shot and shell while fighting for the abolition of slavery, have helped to develop the cotton industry of France and England, as well as the work girls who languish in the factories of Manchester and Rouen, and the inventor who, following the suggestion of some worker, succeeds in improving the looms. How, then, shall we estimate the share of each in the riches which all contribute to amass? Looking at production from its general, synthetic point of view, we cannot hold with the collectivists that payment proportionate to the hours of labor rendered by each would be an ideal arrangement, or even a step in the right direction. Without discussing whether exchange value of goods is really measured in existing societies by the amount of work necessary to produce it, according to the teaching of Adam Smith and Ricardo, in whose steps Marx has followed, suffice it to say here, leaving ourselves free to return to the subject later, that the collectivist ideal appears to us untenable in a society which considers the instrument of labor as a common inheritance. Starting from this principle, such a society would find itself forced from the very outset to abandon all forms of wages. The migrated individualism of a collectivist system certainly could not maintain itself alongside a partial communism, the socialization of land and the instruments of production. A new form of property requires a new form of remuneration. A new method of production cannot exist side by side with the old forms of consumption, any more than it can adapt itself to the old forms of political organization. The wage system arises out of the individual ownership of the land and the instruments of labor. It was the necessary condition for the development of capitalist production, and will perish with it in spite of the attempt to disguise it as profit-sharing. The common possession of the instruments of labor must necessarily bring with it the enjoyment in common of the fruits of common labor. We hold further that communism is not only desirable, but that existing societies, founded on individualism, are inevitably impelled in the direction of communism. The development of individualism during the last three centuries is explained by the efforts of the individual to protect himself from the tyranny of capital and of the state. For a time he imagined, and those who expressed his thought for him declared, that he could free himself entirely from the state and from society. By means of money, he said, I can buy all that I need, but the individual was on a wrong track, and modern history has taught him to recognize that, without the help of all, he can do nothing, although his strong boxes are full of gold. In fact, along this current of individualism, we find in all modern history a tendency, on the one hand to return all that remains of the partial communism of antiquity, and on the other, to establish the communist principle in the thousand developments of modern life. As soon as the communes of the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries had succeeded in emancipating themselves from their lords, ecclesiastical or lay, their communal labor and communal consumption began to extend and develop rapidly. The township and not private persons freighted ships and equipped expeditions for the export of their manufacture, and the benefit arising from the foreign trade did not accrue to individuals, but was shared by all. At the outset, the townships also bought provisions for all their citizens. Traces of these institutions have lingered on into the 19th century, and the people piously cherish the memory of them in their legends. All that has disappeared, but the rural township still struggles to preserve the last traces of its communism, and it succeeds, except when the state throws its heavy sword into the balance. Meanwhile, new organizations, based on the same principle, to every man according to his needs, spring up under a thousand different forms. For without a certain event of communism, the present societies could not exist. In spite of the narrowly egoistic turn given to man's mind by the commercial system, the tendency towards communism is constantly appearing, and it influences our activities in a variety of ways. The bridges for the use of which a toll was levied in the old days have become public property and are free to all.